Tonight, we are in Revelation chapter 6, and we are looking at the opening of the sixth seal. And there are a couple different ways I could go about teaching this tonight and leading our conversation. And there's a way that's really, really easy and doesn't create any headaches or any confusion. And we could do it that way, or we could do the way where we dive in and we do a real deep dive into the text and into biblical prophecy, and it might get a little confusing, but in the end, we'll be better off. And I decided that we should do the hard version, because if we do the hard work now, later on, everything will be much easier. Everything else in Revelation and all of Old Testament prophecy will make more sense. And so I'm going to ask you to follow me. I'm going to try to make my case as clear as I can. If I'm not being clear, tell me. I tried to explain this to Emily, and she's like, no, that seems pretty straightforward, but she also knows how I think, and so she's got a bit of an advantage. But tonight, we're opening the sixth seal, and this is a major event. This is the last seal before the seventh. See, that's why you go to seminary, to learn that six is the last one before seven. You know, that's why you pay for all those classes, but this is the last seal before the seventh seal. Now, as a way of review, the first four seals were four horsemen of the apocalypse that all come together as a unit. So the rider on the white horse, which I believe describes Antichrist, and then the three riders that follow him, the rider on the red horse, the rider on the black horse, and the rider on the green horse, who seem to represent the result of living in a fallen world, that there is warfare, there's famine, and then there's disease and pestilence and these other forms of death that come, and a huge portion of the world population is destroyed. Then the fifth seal happens in heaven. Again, these other seals are opened in heaven, so all the activity is happening in heaven, but the results are on earth. The fifth seal, we see the activity is in heaven, and God is saying there will be results on earth, but we don't see them yet, which is the saints that have died during the tribulation. I believe they're saints who died during the tribulation. They were not believers before the rapture. They came to believe in Christ after the rapture, and then they died. They were martyred during the tribulation, and they are asking, hey, God, how much longer is this tribulation going to last? Basically, that's what they're saying. How much longer are you going to tolerate Antichrist in the world? And I think that's probably a fair estimate of what they're trying to get at. And God says, wait a little longer. Wait a little longer until the last of the martyrs are included, and then judgment will be poured out. But he doesn't give them a number. He doesn't tell them when. He doesn't give them a timeline. He just says, I'm not going to bring vengeance upon Antichrist and all of his ilk until the last martyr dies. And when we think about that, I'll just pause right here. I want to mention something. That seems really strange to our ears, that God is not going to allow any martyr to not be martyred. God knows the total number of believers who are going to suffer and die for him. And what's strange is, we tend to think that God does not return to earth, Jesus doesn't come back because we're waiting for the full number of people who are going to believe to be saved. And I think that's true. God is also delaying his coming so that the full number of those who are going to suffer and die for him is fulfilled. That's also true. So trying to wrap our heads around that at first seems a little strange. Well, God, why would you want more of your children to suffer? Well, Hebrews tells us, we're not going to turn to Hebrews, but Hebrews 12 says that some of them were imprisoned and refused to be released so that they might receive a greater, does anybody remember how that verse finishes? So they might receive a greater resurrection. God, just follow me here if you can. I know this isn't what we're set up to talk about tonight, but I think that this helps us with our biblical theology, is that God is not going to just end things. He is going to give every saint who is willing to die for him the opportunity to die for him. Why? Because they'll receive even more blessings and honors because they suffered for Christ. It is an honor to suffer for Christ. When we look at the New Testament, we look at the testimony of the apostles. The apostles consider it nothing short of a tremendous honor to be found worthy to suffer for Christ. They're not mad when they suffer for Christ. They're happy, and they pray that they will continue to be bold as they suffer for Christ. The uniform teaching of the apostles is that when they suffer for Christ, they are happy about it, because for them, that is just all the more honor and glory that is going to come in their resurrection. They believed that by suffering for Jesus, they would be more honored by Jesus in the end. And so God is not going to wait until, God is not going to come back until every one of the martyrs has died a martyr's death, a pretty horrible, violent martyr's death, but so that they will not lose their opportunity to have a better resurrection, which, I mean, we could spend weeks studying that theology. We won't, but that's anyways worth looking into. Then we see the sixth seal, and the events happen back on earth again. And so we'll pick up in verse 12, and then, like I said, we're going to have to do a deep dive tonight because it gets pretty hairy. Verse 12, "And I saw when he opened the sixth seal, and there became a great earthquake, and the sun became black like sackcloth hair, and the whole moon became like blood, and the stars of the heaven fell into the earth. Like a fig tree casts its unripe figs, quaked by a great wind. And the heaven was split, like a book rolled up, and every mountain and island was removed out of their places, and the kings of the earth, and the great ones, and the tribunes, and the rich, and the strong, and every slave and free, hid themselves into the caves and into the rocks of the mountains. And they said to the mountains and the rocks, 'Fall upon us and hide us from the face of the one sitting upon the throne, for the wrath of the Lamb, because the great day of his wrath came, and who is able to stand?'" Okay, so we are in a complicated passage. It is the opening of the sixth seal, and like I said, it's going to get pretty deep here. The reason it's going to get pretty deep is because we have to make sense of a lot of Old Testament material to make sense of this material. We are in the sixth seal. So in the biblical chronology of Revelation, there are seven seals, because I believe that the seven trumpets and the seven bowls are included within the seventh seal. Now, if you disagree, that's okay. Like, we can still be friends. Like, that's good, people disagree on that. That's totally fine. But in my understanding, we are now 6/7 of the way through. And if you look, the fifth doesn't take up any time. The fifth seal does not take up any time at all. The sixth seal seems to be covering a fairly short span of time. Like, so seal number one, seal number five, seal number six don't take up a lot of time. So seals 2, 3, and 4 have taken up a lot of time. And then the book of Revelation, most of the rest of Revelation will be taken up in the seven bowls and the seven trumpets. But all that to say, we are probably the majority of the way through the tribulation period, depending on how we want to interpret everything. And again, that's an open question. Good scholars that I trust disagree about that. That's okay. But we're most of the way through. And we see what happens when the sixth seal is open. There is these major events that happen. There was a great earthquake. The sun became black like sackcloth hair. The moon became like blood. And the stars of heaven fell into the earth. And heaven is split like a book rolled up. Every mountain and island is removed out of their places. And the kings of the earth and the tribunes and all these people say to the mountains, "Fall on us." Seven events happen here. All of these events happen here. Again, I'll repeat them just to make sure that we all come up with the same number. He opens the sixth seal. There was a great earthquake. Sun became like sackcloth. Moon became like blood. Stars fall out of heaven. The heaven is split and rolled up like a mountain. It's split. Every mountain and island was removed, and the kings of the earth and all these other people and basically everybody else, they go hide in bomb shelters. So we've got these seven events that are wrapped up here. The fact that there are seven of them is significant. That's part of John's theology. But it seems like there are really a couple things that are happening that we can distinguish. One is there is a great earthquake. And it's possible that if there is a great earthquake, now it doesn't say there are many great earthquakes, it says there is a great earthquake and the sun became black like sackcloth. If there were an enormous enough earthquake, or if there were a series of earthquakes that all happened at the same time, it would most certainly make the sun black. You know, I think they talk about Krakatoa. When Krakatoa erupted, Mount Krakatoa, it was an earthquake that happened. I believe what happened was it was a volcano, and like basically the volcano erupted, but it had the effect of being an earthquake too. And so back in, I think it was 1913 when Krakatoa exploded, the mountain basically just blew up, and it caused, people could hear the explosion 3,000 miles away. There were tidal waves 7,000 miles away. Darkness covered land. I mean, how many of you guys were around when Mount St. Helens? Do you guys remember when Mount St. Helens erupted? How dark it was, the darkness that spread over you know, huge portions of Canada and Alaska because of that. So what we're talking about is a major event. There is either a earthquake, a great earthquake, or there is a series of earthquakes that all happen at the same time. This very well could be, this could be a gigantic volcanic explosion. That is very possible. It could be simply, you know, California maybe finally splits off into the Pacific and, you know, and there was much rejoicing. You know, I don't know what's going to happen there, but that could be the thing that happens. But that's not the only thing that happens. This sixth seal not only includes the earthquake, and it seems to me, again, I believe that the sun being blackened is the result of dust being put into the air because of that. The moon becoming like blood. Also, when is the moon red? The moon is red when there's a lot of dust in the air. I mean, that's pretty well-established science there. And then the stars fell to the heaven. Now, this does not literally mean that a star is going to fall from heaven. The Greek word for star does not also include other things. Basically, any lit up celestial body could be considered a star in that kind of theology. So the planets are called planets because the planet means like to wander. So the planets were called wandering stars. That was the thing. And that's why the planets were considered so important in mythology and so important in, you know, reading your horoscope, because the fixed stars, they called them the fixed stars and the planetary stars. That was their terminology, because the fixed stars never moved. I mean, they moved, but they moved in the same pattern. So the whole night sky would stay the same, and it was predictable. They would know it based upon the seasons, and they knew that star will always be in the same place in relationship to that star. But the planets do not behave that way. The planets move around within the night sky. And so when we hear the word star, we shouldn't assume that it's this gigantic, like the sun, like this star falls to Earth. That's not what's being talked about. What I believe is being referred to here is probably an asteroid, probably a significant asteroid. And you guys have probably heard, but you know, even an asteroid that's relatively small could cause untold damage. I mean, just unbelievable damage. There's a famous one in Siberia. There was a famous asteroid hit in Siberia, and the amount of damage it caused, I can't think of where that was, but it was, we don't have a record of it, but it caused unbelievable damage. And it doesn't take a very big asteroid for that to happen. So my guess is, and this is just my guess, is that this is referring to an asteroid coming and hitting the Earth. But other people have other interpretations. Some people say that the star that falls to the Earth is a reference to a demon, to an angel coming, which would not be entirely unreasonable. But it doesn't say the stars fell to heaven. It seems to me that this is referring to probably asteroids, and probably a significant amount of asteroids, that for some reason, either one of a couple things could happen. It could be that the Earth there is an asteroid belt that passes through the Earth. It could be that people are up there trying to mine the asteroids, like we've talked about, and we break it up and it falls out of orbit and this whole scattering of things falls to the Earth. It could be there is some kind of, because we know there's going to be a lot of warfare at this time, it could be that there is, you know, satellites up there, that these things are falling out of the sky. They're falling out of orbit because of combat that's going on in space at that point. Because you take out somebody's satellites, you can really do a lot of damage. So that could be the case as well. But whatever this is, they have to be substantial, and it has to be causing a lot of damage. Don't know exactly what it is. My best guess is, let's presume it's an asteroid. That would make the most sense of what we know about the way the word star was used, and it would fit the context the best. But it said that they fall to the Earth, and they fall to the Earth, interestingly, like a fig tree casts its unripe figs, quaked by a great wind. And notice that word quaked is repeated. We saw that with the earthquake. So this idea is connecting these. So that's another reason why I think that this is probably a natural phenomenon, like an asteroid belt that we hit. Why? Because the seismos, the word seismos is the word for earthquake. That's where we get the word seismology and seismograph and all that stuff. So this seismos shakes the world, and then there's a great wind. There's a seismos that quakes the stars, whatever they are. Okay, so all of this is pretty straightforward. Then we get to heaven was split like a book rolled up, and every mountain and island was removed. Don't know what that means, I'll be honest with you. And most commentators just kind of Just kind of breeze over that one. They don't spend a whole lot of time trying to explain that one. I don't know what it means. Do you guys have any ideas? Because I'm not shooting down any ideas. I'm willing to listen to anything. What is the heavens being rolled up like a scroll mean to you? Whatever it is, it has to be major for it to be, you know, part of this, for the heavens to be split and rolled up like a scroll. I'll be honest, I have no idea. Go ahead, Deanne. Maybe, bud. I don't know. It's whatever it is, it's significant. And again, it seems to me that this is probably a natural phenomenon. But every island, the islands is interesting in John's gospel. Islands show up quite a bit, and islands show up quite a bit in messianic prophecy, in like end times prophecy in the Old Testament. And I'll be honest, I don't really have a complete grasp on what's being meant when they reference it, but they reference the islands quite a bit. I'm not really sure what's going on. I know there's something there. If I get some more time here at some point, I'm gonna do some more research on that and try to figure out what's going on. But there's something significant, and I just can't quite put my finger on it. But if you guys have some ideas, let me know. But the heaven being split and rolled up and every mountain and island being removed seems to be a reference to some kind of, again, a natural phenomenon. When the islands are removed, you know, what's happening? Could there be a major event? Like, could there be shifts in our plates? You know, I mean, plate tectonics has become a pretty well-established scientific theory. You know, so if there is a great earthquake in the sense that there is a major plate shift, a major continental shift, and it could create this huge impact on islands. Maybe islands being removed means they get swamped with tsunamis. It's very possible. There are a lot of different ways that this could be interpreted, but every mountain and island is also removed out of their places. Something happens, and of course, mountains, you know, where do mountains happen? Mountains happen on plates. They happen on continental plates. And so if there's something that affects not just one, if the great earthquake means there's a series of earthquakes because all of the plates on the earth are shifting, if God just reaches down and kind of twists that thing so that every plate shifts, then pretty much every mountain and every island will somehow be removed. This is a tremendous act. Whatever this is something cataclysmic, and it is something that has never happened before. I tend to believe that that's what's going on, personally. I tend to think that this is not one earthquake. It is a series of earthquakes that happen all at one time. That God creates a tectonic shift that shifts every single one of the continental plates. All of them move at the same time. It's one super-duper earthquake. And when that happens, all of this other stuff happens, and that happens in culmination with an asteroid shower upon the earth. And again, it wouldn't take many, but it says all of the stars fell from heaven. Again, could it be that the stars falling from heaven onto the earth means that they were blackened? Could be, but it seems like this is some kind of natural phenomenon. There's you got to get a feeling of rocks and earth and dirt with this. Go ahead, you want to say something, Dan? Really? Oh yes, the polar shifts. I mean, that's something that's actually happening. From the best of my knowledge, we are in the process of that happening. If that would cause, I think the poles shift every. Well, I don't think the Earth has lasted that long, but the theory is that the poles, the Earth goes through a slight movement cycle every, I think, 26,000 years, and they say we're coming up close to when we're going to hit like the point where we return, and that's part of the theory. Maybe some of you guys have heard why the Earth seems to be losing its magnetism. Nobody can figure out why it is. That's one of the theories, at least last I checked. Maybe one of you guys knows more about earth science. Well, I'm sure you know more about earth science than I do, but lots of people do. But that's one of the theories is as the earth's poles are moving, that's part of why the magnetic charge of the earth seems to be dropping. Now, we're also taking a lot of iron out of the ground, so that could like maybe have something to do with it too. You know, you remove a bunch of ferrous metals, but for some reason the magnetism of the earth is changing. So that would be really interesting. I would if you can find anything to look in on that, that might explain something like this, yeah, definitely send it to me. I'd be really interested to see that. Yeah, that'd be awesome. Yeah, thank you. And then we get, and so all of this happens, and like I said, we've got some really heavy material to get into, but I wanted to kind of go over this rather quickly. The really significant thing that happens here, the theologically significant thing that happens is, You look at the people. Oh, by the way, I have a footnote here where it says removed out of their places. It's the same verb as in chapter 2, verse 5, where the church in Ephesus is warned that Jesus will come and remove their lampstand. These are the only two uses of this verb in Revelation or any of John's literature. And so there seems to be a connection. When John uses this word for removed, the thing about Revelation is most literature uses foreshadowing, right? Like you guys all understand that. Foreshadowing is something is mentioned early that then helps you make sense of what comes later. John does what seems to be a lot of backshadowing. John gives us the explanation for stuff that happens earlier, later. And so you interpret, he gives you the information later so that what happened earlier made sense, which is kind of cool because that's how Sherlock Holmes works, right? That's kind of how a murder mystery works or something like that. John is kind of doing that where he says, I'm going to come and remove your lampstand. And you say, well, what does that mean, John? Well, then now the only other time he ever uses that word in all of John's writings is he comes and he describes how the islands are removed. And so it seems to mean that what's going to happen is going to happen in the same way. Now, if I'm right in that John's typical mode in Revelation is to explain things that come before by what happens after, that would mean that we interpret the removal of the lampstand in Ephesians chapter 2 by the removal of the islands in Revelation chapter 6. I'm sorry, the removal of, not Ephesians chapter 2, of the Ephesian church in Revelation chapter 2. If that's correct, then just once again, I'll repeat it. That means that we have to look at this passage to make sense of chapter 2 when Jesus warns the Ephesian church he's going to remove their lampstand. The problem is I have no idea how to interpret this passage right here. So I don't know that that really helps us a whole lot. But what we do see, go ahead, Elsa. You know what? That's an excellent question. We don't really have a time frame. I believe that all of this is going to happen within the 7 years of the tribulation. Some people believe that this is, and we talked about this, I think, last week or 2 weeks ago. Some people believe that all of the stuff, these seals are only going to happen in the second half, or at least the bad stuff is going to happen in the second half called the Great Tribulation. It's not really something I even worry about, arguing about, or discussing. We know that Antichrist breaks his treaty with the people of Israel 3.5 years in. The only numbers that are given in Revelation are, and I mentioned this last week, are 42 months, 1,260 days, or 3.5 years, time, times, and half time. So the only significant number as far as the 70th week of Daniel is 3.5. So if looking at that and you want to say the seven seals all open up in the second half of tribulation, I think you've got a completely good argument. If you want to say that, no, this is covering the entire seven-year span because we go back and we interpret Daniel and we try to make the best sense of what we can, I think you're in good shape too. I think that you are entirely justified, but all of this has to happen within that seven-year time frame. From the rise of Antichrist to his end is 7 years. The 70th week of Daniel is pretty clear about that. So whenever the first seal is open, it might all happen within 3 years, but it has to happen within seven. It can't happen in more than 7 years. So it can happen in less. It can happen in 3.5, or it can happen in seven. But that's, does that make sense? Everybody following that? That was a really good question. So what's significant here is all of these people, and they come, and what do they do? They hide themselves in the caves and in the rocks, and they say to the mountains, by the way, this is in italics because this is an Old Testament quotation. They say to the mountains and the rocks, fall upon us and hide us from the face of the one sitting on the throne and from the wrath of the Lamb, because the great day of his wrath came, and who is able to stand? This is really interesting. And it's interesting for a couple reasons. One, how many of you guys think of lambs as being particularly wrathful? Okay, my daughter is raising her hand. She finds lambs to be very scary, but we were just at the Hillsdale County Fair yesterday, and they had some newly born lambs, and boy, are those things tiny and helpless. You see these newborn lambs, and they're no bigger than a little dog. They're tiny, they're not big, and they're so gentle, they couldn't hurt a fly. They probably do weigh less than my head. Yep. Mom would say they're a lot smaller than my head, but that's, I guess, neither here nor there. But yeah, they're not big, they're small. but the wrath of the Lamb. No one thinks of a lamb. It's interesting. He's already been described as the Lion of Judah, but here they say, hide us from the wrath of the Lamb. That's not an accident. That's not accidental that that's the description being used. Now, maybe they won't actually say those words. Maybe John is saying that they want to be hidden from the wrath that comes from the Lamb, and he's putting words in their mouth. But why is that significant? Yeah, I mean, that's exactly the conclusion I came to. And that's, I think Dr. Hitchcock mentions that in his book, and a lot of other commentators have come to that. So if you came to that on your own, like, bravo, like, maybe you need to write your own book, you know? So, but that's the point that they make, is these people, instead of repenting and turning to God, they call him the Lamb. They don't call him the Lion of Judah. They don't say, hide us from the wrath of the Lion. Don't hide us from this angry God. Don't hide us from this vicious, vengeful God. They say, hide us from the wrath of the Lamb. Hide us from, we want to run away from the one who died for us. We want to run away from the one who is full of grace and mercy. Why would you, and more than that, how stupid is that? Hide us from the wrath. He splits the mountains. He removes the mountains, and they're hiding under the mountains and asking the mountains to hide them. So again, I think that we should take this very literally. Where do we have, where do we see it? We see this all over. All the governments of the world have these mountain fortresses that they can have their governments run to in case of emergencies. Up in where, you guys might know, it's either Norway or Sweden. They have this gigantic mountain, and they have this seed project. So in case there's this major event, they have seeds so that they can grow food for people. It's this huge seed bank. You know, America has NORAD, you know, in Colorado, is it Cheyenne Mountain? The government can all flee to Cheyenne Mountain and hide, you know, we don't know exactly how deep, but it's very deep underground underneath this huge mountain, and they can say, protect us, we'll survive a nuclear holocaust, you know, all these bunkers. And that's what you have, is you've got these people, all these governments have them. England during World War II had these subway tunnels, they had these huge underground fortresses so that the British government could survive under an attack. And so they're coming, but here's the thing, the Nazis can't break through Churchill's, you know, bunker. They couldn't get through Churchill's bunker. And maybe a nuclear bomb can't blast through Cheyenne Mountain. But God removes the mountains because he made them. Like, he just moves them around. And so they're hiding under these things that they know can't stop him. They know this won't actually save them. And so what do they say? They don't just say hide us from him, but they say fall on us. Fall on us. Just let us die. They're asking the mountains to kill them because they don't want to live with the wrath of God. But they could repent because they call him the Lamb. They call him the Lamb. They know that he is full of mercy and grace, and they could repent and turn to him and ask for his grace, but instead they just want to die, and they just want to die. And you look at it and you say, but Luke, that doesn't make any sense. No, it doesn't. It doesn't make any sense. And what we see here, I think that there's a significant connection here to Pharaoh. We've actually been reading with our kids. We've been reading through Exodus. And what do we see with Pharaoh? Pharaoh hardens his heart. God hardens Pharaoh's heart. Pharaoh's heart hardened itself. But other people harden their heart as well. Exactly. The Egyptian leaders, they harden their hearts. And so what we see in this passage, I think, is something very similar to Pharaoh. Now, we've seen stuff in Revelation that mirrors the plagues of Egypt. We've seen that already, and I think this is what we continue to see, is the people are saying the same kinds of things that Pharaoh did. And so you ask the question, why would somebody harden his heart? That's an excellent question. If you can answer that question, you will be, I told Phineas the other day, if you can answer the question of why somebody would harden their heart, you will be the greatest theologian of the last 1,000 years. And you got part of the answer, but you didn't get all of it, and nobody really has that answer. Why would you continue to do it? Why would you do that? But notice some of the language that's used. The day of his wrath has come, and who is able to stand? What happened during the plague of the boils? The wizards and the sorcerers of Egypt were not able to stand before Pharaoh. They weren't able to stand. They couldn't stand before Moses. This idea, it's a very biblical idea. The idea of not being able to stand is you're not able to even show up in court. You're not even able to make a defense. And so they're saying the day of the Lamb's wrath has come, and nobody's even able to give a defense for themselves. But why? Why not turn? We know the hymn, one of my favorite hymns, The Love of God. You know, the second verse, when hoary time shall pass away and earthly thrones and kingdoms fall, when men who hear refuse to pray on rocks and hills and mountains call, God's love so sure shall still endure, all measureless and strong, redeeming grace to Adam's race, the saints and angels' song. God's grace is still available. There will still be, we haven't gotten to the 144,000 yet, and the great multitude of Gentiles. People are still being saved, but all these people hiding in the ground, they refuse his grace. They're refusing his grace. They would rather have the mountains fall on them than they would have to receive the grace of the Lamb. And so we have this really strange passage. It's very strange because it doesn't make sense. And yet, when we look at human behavior, it makes perfect sense because it matches human behavior. How many of you guys know people who deliberately do things that are self-destructive? Anybody who knows an alcoholic or a drug addict or a compulsive gambler? We all know people who do that. Why? Why do you continue to hurt yourself? That's the great question, honey. It is stupid. You're right. Sin is always the dumbest thing you can do. Okay, so now we come to the hard part. Go ahead, Jim. You want to say something? Oh, okay. So now we come to the hard part. And unfortunately, I don't have time to read everything that I wanted to read tonight. But do we have any reference in the Old Testament of a great earthquake? We do. Zechariah 14 specifically mentions a great earthquake. We're not going to turn to Zechariah 14, but we are going to look at Ezekiel chapter 38 and 39. And what I'm going to try to do is, it's really long. I don't know that I have time to read all of it. But what I would recommend for you is when you get home, take some time and read chapters 38 and 39. These are two of the most important chapters in all of Old Testament prophecy. Zechariah 14 is as well. We don't have time to go through them in detail, but these are really, really important passages. You talk about the major passages, the later chapters of Ezekiel, the entire book of Zechariah, the second half of Daniel. These are really important, but chapters 38 and 39 are super duper important. So Ezekiel 38 and 39 are really important. Now, what Ezekiel 38 and 39 tell us about, in 38 and 39, specifically Ezekiel 38, 20, it says, "The fish in the sea, the birds in the sky, the beasts in the field, every creature that moves along the ground, and all the people on the face of the earth will tremble at my presence. The mountains will be overturned, the cliffs will crumble, and every wall will fall to the ground." So this is referring to a great earthquake, the likes of which the world has never seen. Every mountain, he's not saying most of them, he's not saying some of them, he's not saying Mount Zion, he's not saying, you know, Mount Olivet. We know there will be a great earthquake when Jesus returns to Mount Olivet, and Mount Olivet is split. The Mount of Olives will be split, but this is saying every mountain. This isn't just referring to that. This is every mountain. And so we see that there's this great act of judgment that God carries out. Here's the problem, and I'm going to lay out the problem to you guys, and then hopefully, if I say anything at any point along this that doesn't make sense, stop me and make sure we get it. Okay, because this can get a little bit tricky. So we look at this and we are very tempted to say, okay, we have in Zechariah 14, which is also end times prophecy, and we have Ezekiel chapter 38, which talks about a great earthquake, which is end times prophecy, and we have Revelation chapter 6, which is end times prophecy, and they all mention a great earthquake. Great. Super duper. That means John is referring to Ezekiel 38 and 39. Excellente. We got a problem, though. The problem is, when we read the context of Ezekiel chapters 38 and 39, they're referring to the war of Gog and Magog. It's referring to these princes who are making war against Jerusalem, and as they make war against Jerusalem, all these other things happen. Now, you say, well, Luke, what's the problem? Doesn't Revelation talk about a war of Gog and Magog? Absolutely, the book of Revelation does. But that's the rub. See, the rub is Ezekiel chapters 38 and 39, like I said, we don't have time to read all of it, but this is clearly stuff that happens before Messiah comes. Jewish interpreters of prophecy, non-Christians, granted, they're not Christians, but they're those of them who haven't fallen into Reform Judaism, those of them who actually believe that these are actual prophecies by God that will be fulfilled, they believe that these are the things that usher in the coming of Messiah. These happen before Messiah comes. And you say, okay, Luke, that's awesome, because that also fits in with what we read in Revelation chapter 6. This happens before Messiah returns. They would say comes the first place. We would say before he returns. So this interpretation, Revelation chapter 6, Ezekiel 38 and 39, same kinds of things. This is the same cluster of events. It makes sense with the material we have. It makes sense with the historical tradition of interpretation, and it makes sense with what we see in other New Testament passages, specifically Matthew describing the end times in Mark. So Matthew 24 and Mark 13. Again, you're like, great, Luke, that's awesome. You said there was a problem. Here's the problem. If we turn to Revelation chapter 20, you'll see the problem quite quickly. Revelation chapter 20. After the 1,000 years. When the 1,000 years are over, verse 7, let me repeat that again so that we know that we're working with a fixed timeline here. When the 1,000 years are over, Satan will be released from his prison, and he will go out to deceive the nations in the four corners of the earth, Gog and Magog, and to gather them for battle. In number, they are like the sand on the seashore. They marched across the breadth of the earth and surrounded the camp of God's people in the city he loves, but fire came down from heaven and devoured them. And the devil who deceived them was thrown into the lake of burning sulfur, where the beast and the false prophet had been thrown. They will be tormented forever, day and night. And you look at this and you say, oh, man, this also looks an awful lot like Ezekiel chapter 38 and 39, where Gog and Magog are referenced. And here in Revelation chapter 6, Gog and Magog are not mentioned at all. Whew! Are we starting to see the problem? Let me make it even more clear why there's a problem. There are two terms in Latin that I want you to hear. You don't have to remember them, but if you do remember them, I'll get you an ice cream sandwich or something, right? So there are these two terms. Terminus a quo. Terminus a quo means the stopping point from which. So it's a stopping point from which you move forward. And then there's terminus ad quem. Terminus ad quem is the stopping point from which you can't go any further. So in theology, we use these terms to say that there's a fixed time that something has to happen between a beginning point and an end point. If it has to fit within two points of time, we say that it has a terminus a quo and a terminus ad quem. Okay, so when you have a fixed beginning and a fixed end, you have a terminus a quo and a terminus ad quem. You have they're called termini or terminuses. You can call them both. Ezekiel 38 and Revelation 6 have both a terminus a quo and a terminus ad quem. The terminus a quo, the point from which it can't be before, is the opening of the first seal, and that has to happen during the tribulation. All of this has to happen within that 7-year period after the rapture. But it cannot happen before Jesus returns. It has to happen before Revelation 19, before Jesus returns to the earth. That means that we have a fixed point of time. It has to happen within those 7 years. You have a terminus ad quo, a terminus ad quo, a terminus ad quem. You have a fixed beginning, a fixed end. The fixed beginning is it can't happen before the tribulation starts. It can't happen after Jesus returns. I know I'm being pedantic. Trust me, it'll make sense. Revelation 20 also has two termini. It cannot happen before the 1,000 years are over. It can't happen before that. It has to happen after the 1,000 years, which means it has to happen after Satan has been judged the first time, which means it has to happen after Jesus has returned. And its terminus ad quem is, well, it is the terminus. It's before the eternal state begins, before the great judgment of the world. So if you're keeping score at home, that means that the reference to Gog and Magog in Ezekiel chapter 38 and 39 have to happen within the tribulation period. The reference to Gog and Magog in Revelation chapter 20 have to happen after Jesus has returned and before the great judgment of the world. These cannot overlap. They cannot be referring to the same thing. But the problem is that the name Gog and Magog are only used here in this cluster to refer in Ezekiel chapter 38 and 39 and Revelation chapter 20. This is the only place where they're used in this way. So now we have a problem. They can't be both right. If this is the same event, they can't both be right. Either Ezekiel is right about his timeline or John's right about his timeline. They can't both be right. This either happens before the parousia, before Jesus returns, or it happens after, but it can't be both. Do you guys see the problem? They are mutually exclusive. They cannot be. Ezekiel 38 and 39 and Revelation 20 cannot be referring to Gog and Magog. And yet you look at the descriptions, and I mean, trust me, go home and read about it. The descriptions are incredibly similar. This seems like an enormous problem. It's actually good. Okay, so I'll relieve the tension. This is actually a really good thing. Here's why this is a really good thing. Because they cannot possibly be referring to the same event, we don't have to try to make them the same event. We can recognize that they're two different events. There are two wars of Gog and Magog, and you say, well, Luke, that's a little bit convenient, isn't it? I mean, that's a nice little way of escaping the problem. Well, no, it's not a convenient way of escaping the problem. What it is there are two events that are going to be so similar, they're going to be so eerily similar in how they play out, that they can actually be described as something by the same name. You see the same people involved, you see the same places involved, you see the same kind of event involved, which is what happens in the first war of Gog and Magog that we read about in Ezekiel 38 and 39. And we also read about it in the earlier chapters, in Daniel, we read about it in the earlier chapters of Revelation. All the nations of the world gather and surround Jerusalem. Matthew talks about it. They surround Jerusalem. They're ready to attack it. They want to conquer Jerusalem. And what happens? Jesus returns and wipes them out. He destroys them. He puts Satan in judgment for 1,000 years. He binds Satan, and everything is goody gumdrops for 1,000 years. What happens after the 1,000 years are ended and Satan is released? The same exact thing. People decide to rebel against God, and they surround Jerusalem, meaning to make war against Messiah, and he destroys them again. Now you say, well, Luke, who would do that? That's so stupid. People do stupid things all the time. When the great deceiver comes out, they will do the exact same thing. And so I believe what's happening in Revelation 20 is this. John is saying that what's going to happen when Satan is released the second time is going to be so eerily similar to what happened 1,000 years before that people are going to say it's the same thing. They're going to use the same, like we use the word World War I, World War II. A lot of people say, well, it was really just one war. That's debatable. We'll let the historians wrestle that out. But it was a world war. People are like, this has never happened before. This is a world war. And they're like, oh, crap, this is a world war again. So, like, we have to come up with a name for it. Oh, well, let's call that one World War I and that one's World War II. You know, like, people are really clever at coming up with names. You know, so they called it World War I and World War II. I think that this is what we see. We see Gog and Magog 1 and Gog and Magog 2. And you say, well, Luke, why would people rebel? Why would God release Satan? Well, I think we'll get to it later, but I think why God releases Satan is because God wants to prove to the world, even after 1,000 years of everything going well, everything is going swimmingly, and God is ruling in kindness and goodness on earth, people still rebel against him. Mankind was not improved. Humanity did not get better. Our fallenness in Adam continued to poison us. And even under perfect conditions, people will still rebel against God. Now, we'll talk about that more later. We can discuss that later. We can discuss it later tonight, I guess, if you want. But here's the point. We look at Ezekiel 38 and 39, which are really important texts for understanding Revelation. And it seems to me that we can tie chapter 6 with that great earthquake to what we see in 38 and 39. There are Zechariah chapter 14, we can look at that, and maybe Zechariah 14 is probably referring to the same event. This great earthquake is something the likes of which the world has never seen and is never going to see again. We see this great event that's happening, and again, what's the result? Same as the result of people when they rebel against God after the 1,000 years. People hate God. That's the problem. The problem is not that people do not have enough education. The problem is not this Maslowian theory that they don't have their basic physical needs met. No, the problem is not that people don't have enough education. It's not a problem of not having enough psychology. It's not a problem of meeting people's physical needs. The problem is that humans hate God. They hate God. That's the problem. People hate God and want to do what they want to do. And when God says, don't do that, they say, I don't care, I'm going to do it anyways. And when God says, it's going to hurt you, they say, I don't care, I'm going to do it anyways. When he says, I'm going to judge you if you do this, if you rebel against me, if you hate me, I will hate you back. And they say, I don't care, I'm going to do it. And so that is what we see, is people deliberately, knowledgeably, knowingly, volitionally choosing to hate God, rejecting his grace, knowing that his grace is available and still rejecting it. I don't think these people can even be called atheists. They know who's doing the damage. See, that's the amazing thing about Revelation. They know that it's God punishing them. I don't think there are going to be many atheists in the tribulation period. I think people are going to know that it's God who's doing it. I mean, the capacity for self-deception is almost limitless in human beings. I mean, people are really good at lying to themselves. So there could be some atheists, but these people seem to know what's going on. They know it's God. So, I mean, are they atheists in the sense that they reject God? Maybe they do. Like, maybe that's what they say, is like, oh, I don't believe there's God. I think this is just all accidents. But that's not really what's going on. Deep down in their hearts, they know that this is God judging them. I think that's going to be really clear. I don't think there are going to be many atheists in the tribulation period. I think we're seeing that already in the world today. Atheism is going by the wayside. The great push of atheism was really at the end of modernism, and now that we're moving fully into postmodernism, I think we're going to see a lot of paganism. I think we're going to see more and more open Satanism. Let me say this, and then I'll shut up, because I know that this is probably tedious to anybody who doesn't care. But C.S. Lewis talked about what his great fear was. He believed that there was going to be what he called a secular magician. And when you hear about a secular magician, you're like, that doesn't make any sense, because secularists don't believe in a God. They don't believe in the supernatural, and yet a magician does. A magician does believe in the supernatural. So these seem to be confused terms. And you're like, okay, C.S. Lewis, what are you talking about? Here's what I think C.S. Lewis saw and what he saw happening. So pre-modern people that lived before the Enlightenment, I'm putting Enlightenment in big air quotes, people who lived before the Enlightenment, there were two fundamental descriptions of how those people existed. First, they believed that truth was absolute, that truth is truth, truth is absolute, and they believed that your beliefs, your faith, came before what you experienced, what you knew, what you could test. So faith was more important to them than scientific reasoning. You believed something, and then you found verification for it. Does that make sense? So it was to use the expression, it was faith seeking understanding, not understanding seeking faith. So pre-modern people, truth is absolute, faith precedes reason. There are other ways to describe that, but that's generally how it is. Modernism said truth is absolute, but it's the other way around. It's actually reason leads you to believe things. Your reason leads you to faith. Postmodernism flipped it again. Postmodernism said, no, truth is not absolute. So they reject what the pre-moderns said, because the pre-moderns, you know, the medievals and people like that, they say, no, truth isn't absolute, but they act like medievals by saying that, well, but faith does lead you to reason. You believe, because that's what the postmodernists believe. They're like, well, if you believe something, it's true for you, which is stupid, but that's what they say. If you believe something, it's true for you. So truth is not absolute, and faith leads to reason. Belief leads to knowledge. But we're missing one. You notice you've got two categories, and we've seen three of the four combinations. We haven't seen the fourth of the four. The fourth of the four combinations is that truth is not absolute, and that reason leads to faith. And I think that's what we're starting to see now. We're seeing post-postmodernism. Now, some people say that's impossible, but post-postmodernism is truth is not absolute, but your faith leads to reason. And what that gives the opportunity for is what Lewis talked about, the secular magician, the scientist magician, who believes that he can gain knowledge through his study, but he doesn't believe in absolute truth. And you're like, well, how could you be a scientist and not believe in truth? Easy. Look at the people teaching in our universities right now. And so we're going to see that. And I think that we will see literally, I think we're going to see more of that. Anyways, if you're interested in that kind of stuff, that was probably really interesting. If you find that stuff boring, then you're like, Luke, shut up. We need to get done. I'll talk to you in a minute, buddy. So any other questions or comments before we wrap up for tonight? I mean, I would say that moving to a cashless society, I think we talked about this way back when, that I think that One of the things that will help Antichrist have power is if we have a cashless society, a fully electronic society, a fully electronic economy. I think that will empower evil people. Evil people don't want people to be able to freely exchange goods and services. Like that does not help tyrants. Tyrants don't like black markets. They do because then they can like put people in jail for them, and that's another way to make more criminals. But tyrants don't like people being able to freely exchange goods and services because it takes away their power. If I can sell one of my shotguns to Jim because Jim needs another shotgun. Do you need another shotgun? He always needs another shotgun. If I can sell another shotgun to Jim, and he'll do it in trade with me, either for I take gold and silver. Or if he wants to do some work on my car, well, that's perfectly fine for me. I love barter. Government doesn't like barter. Why? Because they don't get a piece of it. Why? Because they can't control it. They can't tell Jim what to do. They can't tell me what to do. So I think that the coin shortage is not necessarily part of it, but it's certainly a sign of what's coming in the future. I don't think that the coin shortage is an accident. But that's just my opinion. I could be completely wrong about that. But anybody else? Yes. How do they know it's God? I think that what's going to happen are things that are so dramatic and so powerful that only God could do it. And people will know. There's also the reality that God does speak to people in a way that can't be refuted, that can't be denied. Anybody else before we wrap up? All right, thank you guys.